This is Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability. I'm Alex Wise.
We've seen in the context of climate change, but in other contexts as well, that when we frame difficult challenges as health challenges, that can help bring people together to solve problems.
When a member of your household feels unwell, a good first step is to find the thermometer. If there's a fever, it could be something serious. Well, these days our planet is exhibiting signs of illness, from swarms of locusts in East Africa and Southwest Asia, to the smoke spreading from California's infernos, to a massive release of greenhouse gases from once frozen, now burning Siberia. And COVID itself may serve as both a metaphor and an exemplar of the inextricable connection between the planet's health and that of our species. This week on Sea Change Radio, we speak to Howard Frumkin, a physician and environmentalist who recently co-authored a book entitled Planetary Health, Protecting Nature to Protect Ourselves. We talk about how the pandemic exposes planetary health issues related to food, population, and politics, and touch on what we can do to bring the patient's fever down. I'm joined now on Sea Change Radio by Dr. Howard Frumkin. He and his colleague Samuel Myers have just edited a new book called Planetary Health, Protecting Nature to Protect Ourselves. Howard, welcome to Sea Change Radio.
Thank you, Alex. Nice to be with you.
So, Howard, you started this book before the pandemic kicked in, but as we're going to see very soon, a lot of the lessons that you are outlining apply very much so to a pandemic-oriented world. What was kind of the motivation that you and Dr. Myers had to write Planetary Health before the pandemic? And now, with this in mind, give us kind of how it's come into a clearer focus for you.
Well, even before the pandemic started, it was clear that changes to our planet are accounting for a bigger and bigger proportion of suffering, illness, and death across the world. The changes are big. They don't just include climate change, which is the one everybody knows about, but we're losing biodiversity, we're changing the chemistry of the oceans, we're changing the way elements like nitrogen and phosphorus cycle through the atmosphere and the Earth. This is not the same planet that our grandparents lived on. And that, of course, has implications for all of us who live on the planet. So the notion of planetary health is that we have to protect the planet to protect ourselves. We can't be a healthy species, we can't be healthy people, unless we have a healthy planet to live on. And it turns out you anticipated exactly that a pandemic is a good example of planetary health principles. So we felt that the book was timely, although the timeliness was tragic.
So if you had to define planetary health, what would you tell somebody who's not familiar with the term, and how has the modern environmentalism movement kind of reflected a change in that definition of the term?
Well, I guess the core definition of planetary health would be this. It's a scientific approach that fully integrates Earth and atmospheric sciences and ecology, all of the studies that we make of the planet, with biomedical sciences, all the studies that we make of human health and well-being. The notion is that you can't just study human health and well-being without grounding that in understanding of how our planet functions. And we can't just study planetary functions without paying a lot of attention to human health and well-being.
And you studied as an internist, right? Internal medicine physician, which is quite different from the usual course that one might see from an environmentalist. How did you come to look at this as a field of study for yourself?
Well, my own journey, as you said, began with primary care internal medicine. You do learn some systems thinking when you train to be an internist. So you understand, for example, that hormonal changes affect neurodevelopment and neurodevelopment affects cardiovascular risks and so on. In fact, it's the first law of ecology. Everything is connected to everything. So it's not a very big leap from there, from thinking about human health as a complex system, to thinking about the ways that human health interact with natural systems. So I kind of became an amateur ecologist. Then I got interested in the field of environmental health, and that's been my career. So I've thought about issues like the built environment, community design, cities, and how those things influence our health and well-being. Almost like a zookeeper, thinking about the best way to take care of my animals, I think about humans in the context of the habitat where we live. There are healthy habitats and there are not such healthy habitats. And that's true from the small scale of the rooms and buildings that we spend our time in, all the way up to the planet.
And a lot of times we assume that internists will only be focused on what's going on inside the body. But of course, as modern internal medicine has evolved, we're learning that there are so many external factors that go into having a healthy body, such as diet. And so you tackle food systems, and it's kind of a good bridge between the study of the body and the study of the planet. What are some of the most glaring problems with our food systems from a planetary perspective that you address in the book?
Well, that's a great question, and let me answer that not only from the planetary perspective, but from the human health perspective as well. So on a planetary scale, we've got several big challenges with our food system. We're not supplying enough healthy, nutritious food to everybody on the planet, and that's a bottom line requirement for the food system. One of the problems is that we waste about a third of the food that we create. That food just never gets eaten. Another problem is that we're probably creating the wrong kinds of food. We create a lot of livestock, and that requires a lot of crops to feed the livestock. That requires a lot of land and water and chemical inputs to grow all those crops to feed the livestock. And that's not very efficient. The efficiency of turning energy from plants into animals is low. So we would do a lot better at feeding everybody on the planet if we shifted a little bit away from eating animal protein toward eating plants. That would also be a lot healthier for us because the high meat diets that are characteristic of the U.S. and Europe and Argentina and Brazil and Uruguay, many parts of the world, are not as healthy as more plant-based diets. It also turns out that we use a lot of inputs in our food system. We use a lot of pesticides and herbicides and fertilizers, and those are environmentally costly and destructive. A lot of the pesticides are bad for our health. A lot of the fertilizers take a huge amount of energy to produce and therefore have big carbon footprints. So all in all, if you were designing a food system that you wanted to be nutritious and ample for everybody, and affordable and environmentally sustainable, it wouldn't look a lot like the food system we have now.
No, it would be focused on quality rather than quantity. Although when you have so many people, you could see why the systems would be built into trying to provide as much nutrition to as many people as possible. But that ultimately doesn't lead to a uniformly healthier food system, does it?
Well, the Green Revolution 50, 60, 70 years ago was a huge step forward for humanity. It relieved enormous hunger on an enormous scale. But part of the thinking behind the Green Revolution was, let's get as much production out of every acre of farmland as we possibly can. So it's production per acre. That's not necessarily the metric we want. The metric I'd like to see us use is, how many people are we feeding nutritionally wholesome diets per acre? And that means that we'd look a lot more at the kinds of food we're producing, at whether the micronutrient supply is adequate, not just the calories, and at whether the food is healthy without too many contaminants or adulterants. So it is a quality and a nutritional set of metrics, not just a productivity set of metrics.
Yes, if our baseline is just not starving where are we? We haven't really evolved past the Irish potato famine.
Well, that's right. And not only is that true now, but it's becoming more true over time. And the reason for that is that as climate change advances and as carbon dioxide levels in the atmosphere rise, what we're learning is that the nutritional content of some foods is declining. A lot of crops don't do as well at integrating nutrients like zinc and iron into the plant matter as they do at lower carbon dioxide levels. So we need to be thinking more than ever about the overall nutritional content of our diets, and even thinking about changing what we eat, developing new crops so that they can be resilient to climate change and continue to be nutritious.
What foods in particular are you thinking of when you talk about foods losing their nutritional value?
Oh, across the fruit and vegetable worlds, most fruits and vegetables have declining nutritional value with higher levels of CO2. And that's not to mention other climate change threats as well. As the weather gets more chaotic, as wet parts of the world get wetter and dry parts get drier, agriculture suffers a lot. And so we're seeing diminished productivity across a band of Africa. We're seeing diminished agricultural output in Latin America. And those things have knock-on effects. So, for example, if an entire region becomes agriculturally crippled, then the people who live there and make their living growing food can't stay there, and they migrate. And so the climate change impacts on agriculture not only have affected nutrition, but they've triggered migration crises in several parts of the world. And these are only small crises compared to what's likely to come as climate change extends its impact.
Begin to lose sight. You can't see very clearly when you're in flight. It's high time that you find the same people you walk on your way up. You might meet up on your way down.
On your way down.
If you enjoy the music you hear on Sea Change Radio, please consider checking out Fog Swamp, a musical group led by Sea Change host Alex Wise. Go to fogswamp.com to stream or download Fog Swamp's most recent studio release, Drop Days. That's fogswamp.com.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Dr. Howard Frumpkin. His new book is Planetary Health. So Howard, we were talking about the Irish potato famine. You look at that in the book, along with the Oklahoma Dust Bowl, as two recent examples of how environmental pressures amplify demographic, economic stressors. We are now seeing this with COVID as well. How do you view the Irish potato famine and the Oklahoma Dust Bowl through a planetary health lens? And how do you think we're going to look back at the COVID-19 pandemic in, let's say, 30, 40 years in terms of lessons that we can learn from it?
Well, these are all complicated issues, but a couple of lessons we can draw from them and then apply to COVID. With the Irish potato famine, you had a couple of problems. You had over-reliance on a single crop, which actually is a problem in many parts of the agricultural world these days. You had the weather taking a turn for the worse, which made the crop difficult to grow, something that's happening with climate change. And you had tyrannical governance by the British in Ireland that aggravated the effects of the famine. So poor governance is a problem in many parts of the world now as well. In the Oklahoma Dust Bowl, you had destructive soil stewardship. You had practices that involved deep plowing of soil that had for millennia been stabilized by the grass that grew on it. That was aggravated by a bad turn in the weather, And once again, without social safety nets, the people who lived in those affected regions were devastated and had to migrate. Flash forward, how do those lessons apply to COVID? Well, we've got a modern world with a lot of people, with expanding human footprints of habitation, and with people moving into ecosystems where livestock, where wildlife lives, increasing human-wildlife contact. You've got several cultures around the world where wildlife becomes a part of the food system, and so people come into contact intimately with wildlife in wet markets. You've got industrial-scale production of livestock in many parts of the world where huge numbers of cows or pigs or chickens live in what we humans would regard as slums, crowded, unsanitary conditions. All of those farming practices and consumption practices are perfect setups for viruses to spill over from the animal kingdom to the human kingdom. And on top of that, we're a very globalized world now. People jump on planes and are halfway across the world in no time at all. So if you're a virus, this is a perfect set of circumstances for you to spread, to mutate, and to jump into the human population.
Yes, what we remember from the Oklahoma Dust Bowl is the dust, but what caused that dust? It was that monocultural farming. And similarly, we look at like death tolls from COVID-19, but we don't necessarily look at what were some of the systems that were in place that allowed 215,000 Americans to die. A lot of people say we could look right at our political system and our leadership and the bifurcated political process we have right now, where it's red team and blue team, and the president has decided that we don't really need to look at things through a scientific lens, and that things like masks are for wimps. How much do you think we'll look back at this as being specific to the Trump era and the lack of leadership in the Republican political side of things in the U.S. versus lessons like we've taken from the Dust Bowl and the potato famine, which are much more systemic?
Well, I think on this issue of how we utilize science, we've got at least two big problems. One is that we've degraded the value of scientific insight, and that's very much a function of the Trump era. But it predates the Trump era. We saw science being challenged by tobacco manufacturers 20, 30 years ago when the evidence emerged that tobacco is bad for health, and a lot of the same techniques then deployed in favor of obfuscating climate science, so that a lot of issues become politicized that really shouldn't be politicized. And a lot of the conspiracy theories and anti-scientific tropes then get magnified by social media. So the combination of politicization of science and the spread of disinformation in social media is very toxic. But there's a second layer as well. Not only does science get devalued, but in many cases, we don't do the right kind of science. People turn to science for simple answers. They want quick silver bullet solutions. But one of the lessons of planetary health is that things are really complicated. It's very tough to take a complex problem like food systems, land use, migration, and reduce that all to simple sound bites or simple solutions. So we need not only to pay a lot more attention to science, but we need an appreciation of complexity and nuance, which is very tough in an era of sound bites.
So you're talking about cultivating better scientific processes, but how do we cultivate political processes to support changes in the right direction?
Well, that's a huge question, and I don't pretend to have all the answers, but I think part of the answer is focusing on human health. And that's one of the central themes of this planetary health framework that we've been talking about. Wherever you are on the political spectrum, you probably care about your health, and you probably care about your kids' and your grandkids' health. We've seen in the context of climate change, but in other contexts as well, that when we frame difficult challenges as health challenges, that can help bring people together to solve problems.
And then combining that human health concern with nature and our world around us. Let's look at Ecuador, which 12 years ago became the first nation to recognize the rights of nature in its constitution. We don't have that here in the U.S., I don't believe. I think we can all acknowledge that there's some real intrinsic value of having clean air and clean water. But what other rules might help us as we face the decisions of our future other than just creating a rights of nature clause in our constitution? How can we bolster that idea?
You know, one of the most encouraging and interesting trends in the last couple of decades, from my point of view, has been a kind of a reawakening of the awareness that nature has value for us. Richard Louv, the great author, in his book, Last Child in the Woods, coined the term nature deficit disorder. He extended that to adults as well, and he pointed out, as many have, that the estrangement from nature, the disconnectedness from nature that's been a part of our collective lives for the last couple of generations, can't be good for us. And that's become very clear in the era of COVID. How many people have craved escaping cabin fever and isolation and anxiety and depression and loneliness by getting out into the outdoors? How many city park departments closed the parks down for COVID only to hear pushback from the public who really needed to get outside and get a little bit of a nature recharge? So I think reinstating the relationship with nature, working natural education into the education of kids, making it easier for families to be in the outdoors, creating parks in every city and all the neighborhoods where people live so that people can get contact with nature, that's a good social policy and it's good health policy. And I think it's likely to reinstate a sense of stewardship and caring for the natural world, which will in turn redound to the benefit of human health in many, many ways.
Trying to be green, recycle, reduce, and reuse. Green is a lifestyle for those in the know, but my life is ruled by the blues. As for me, blue is all that I see. It's my personal muse. Watching the world through azure glasses, I'm colorblind. Sun glows yellow, the fields are green, so many colors to choose. When fall comes around and the leaves turn brown, I'm still colorblind with the blues.
This is Alex Wise on Sea Change Radio, and I'm speaking to Dr. Howard Frumkin. If you look at the pandemic, a lot of cities are starting to change just in the last 6 to 8 months. We look at population trends and where concentrations of these populations are going. How do we discuss the environmental impacts of population in a dispassionate scientific way without sounding callous?
It's a great question. And as you implied, Alex, there's a long and shameful history of approaches to population growth being conflated with racism, with imperialism, with a sense of entitlement on the part of wealthy societies. In fact, the larger the human population, the bigger our footprint on the earth. So it's a worthy subject of discussion, but in the very same breath, the levels at which we consume matter a huge amount. The typical American has an environmental footprint that's 50, 60, 70 times larger than the environmental footprint of somebody in Malawi or in Guatemala. So we need to talk both about consumption patterns and about population. To ignore one or the other is like ignoring the formula for the area of a rectangle. It's height times width, and they both matter equally. Now, when it comes to population, there are some very, very tried and true successful methods of reducing birth rates that don't involve any sort of coercion or disrespect. And those methods are educating girls and empowering women. Those are win-win solutions, no-regrets solutions. In countries around the world, when girls are educated, when women are empowered, birth rates come down. So those are goals that are morally and practically necessary for all kinds of reasons, but in addition to all of those reasons, they do help bring population down. And it'll be that that helps us stabilize the global population at some point in the next century and will help us get on top of all of the environmental destruction that we need to tackle.
Howard, this is a grim time, 2020, for so many of us. This book gives us a lot more to worry about. So first I want you to talk about some of the things that worry you the most personally during this period, and then what gives you hope?
Well, what worries me is two or three things. Of all of the grim trends that we can detect now, I worry about nutrition, because I think the world's food supply is going to be very challenged in coming decades. I worry about migration and conflict, because I think that as resources get scarce, as people need to vacate certain parts of the world and relocate, we've already seen a lot of pushback against migration. And I think that'll probably get worse. And I worry about poverty and inequality. We have way too much of that already, both within our country and on a global scale. The more of the poverty and inequality we confront, the less able we are to tackle other problems, and the more people suffer. Excuse me. So those are the things that worry me. What gives me hope is knowing that the solutions to all of these problems are at hand. We have a lot of agricultural insight. We know how to grow more food. We know how to cut agricultural waste. We know how to feed the world if only we do it. We are moving very fast in energy technologies, in shifting from fossil fuels to renewables, in energy storage. We're electrifying our vehicle fleets. And so I think that our uses of energy are changing fast, and we know what we need to do, and we're doing it. I think we're seeing changes in our cities and neighborhoods that bring them in a more sustainable and more healthy direction. Young people don't care so much about having lots of space. Young people don't care so much about owning their own vehicles. Once we get through COVID, we'll be back to the trend that's been evident for the last decade or two, which is moving back into cities, having vibrant, pleasant cities. And I think if anything, COVID will spur us to make cities even better with more green space, more parks, more street surface dedicated to walking and cycling instead of driving. So across the spectrum from energy to urban design to food and agriculture, we know a lot of the solutions. They're being implemented very broadly. I'm seeing a lot of progress in many quarters. So that's what gives me hope.
The book is Planetary Health, Protecting Nature to Protect Ourselves. Dr. Howard Frumkin. Howard, thanks so much for being my guest on Sea Change Radio.
It's been an honor. Thanks very much, Alex.
Sway the future to the past and find what will endure.
You've been listening to Sea Change Radio. Our intro music is by Sanford Lewis, and our outro music is by Alex Wise. Additional music by Fog Swamp. Check out our website at seachangeradio.com. That's seachangeradio.com to stream or download the show or subscribe to our podcast. Visit our archives there to hear from Bill McKibben, Van Jones, Paul Hawken, and many others. And tune in to Sea Change Radio next week as we continue making connections for sustainability. For Sea Change Radio, I'm Alex Wise.